Jim Slaughter, our today's speaker, is now an associate professor with the Department of Curriculum, Teaching and Learning and the Center of Science, Mathematics and Technology Education at OISE. OISE is the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto, a famous institution. Jim studied physics for his bachelor's degree at the Case Institute of Technology. After that, he made a Master's of Science in Cognitive Psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and then also a PhD in Cognitive Psychology that he received from the University of Pittsburgh. In our little preparation meeting, we agreed that Jim will himself give a little bit more of a context for his current research, also giving a little bit of historical overview on his different stations of his academic career. And I'm really happy to have him here today and to hand over control over that session to Jim for now.
Okay, well, hello everybody, and thank you very much on the West Coast, especially for getting up in the morning, and in Europe for staying up into the evening, and Frank, especially to you for making this vision that you had so many years ago, I guess a few years ago now, to making it a reality. And it's been very impressive to those of us who have been watching that you could put together this speaker series, and it's mainly through your own work and Fritis and Daniel and the people at LMU to make it possible. So thank you for inviting me. And I'm going to talk today about collective inquiry, which is a focus on learning at the community level. I am not an expert at this. In fact, after 7 years now or 8 years of doing it, I feel that I'm still a novice at this. But I'm knowledgeable enough to know that it's a different kind of lens for learning than thinking about the individual. And Jerry Stahl made that point as well in his talk about group cognition. And I liked his analytic lens of just looking at interactions and not thinking about knowledge in the head, which I'm sure he would agree that knowledge does happen in the head. I don't know how I exactly stand on that, but maybe after the talk you could tell me what you think. I sent some slides out by Dropbox, and I think we're going to put the URL here. See if this works. Well, it mashed it all up. You'll see in the chat there's two URLs, and the first one starts with HTTPS and ends with PPTX. So those are the slides. If you haven't downloaded them, you can. I'm going to try to talk without obviously showing them in a screen share. I'll use them because it'll help me guide my own thinking. And if you would like to follow along, what I'm going to try to do is avoid being extremely fixed to the slides, so that it makes sense to just watch the boring talking head. I usually like to have slides up, but there was something very nice and social about Jeremy's presentation, which is one that I watched, Jeremy Rochelle. And one of the things he began with, I can start talking about this if you are currently downloading the slides. And by the way, I will keep my eye on the text message. So if you have any confusion about what slide we're on, and if you want to ask me, I'll just stop and tell you. But Jeremy sort of started off with a bit of a personal narrative of his own trajectory through the world of the learning sciences, and I thought that was a nice way to get to know him on a more personal level. So from my perspective, what that looks like is I began in natural sciences. I came out of a physics background and went into naturally drawn to the cognitive aspects of physics learning. So I went to the University of Pittsburgh, which was and still is a great strength in that category of work. And my own PhD work was with Mickey Chi. If you don't know Mickey Chi's work, you ought to have a look at her papers. They tell a wonderful trajectory through the last 25, 30 years. But my work studied how physics novices picked up new ideas and developed new ideas, or sometimes could not develop new ideas because of things that they knew already. So it was a cognitive psychology doctorate. And at the end of it, I decided it would be nice to go put some of those experiences and research background that I had into a more socially engaged field, which I saw education as being that. So I basically left cognitive psychology at that point and went into the education field. And I got my postdoc at the University of California in Berkeley, where Phil Bell, who's here today, was a PhD student. And actually the two of us worked quite a lot together with Chris Hoadley and Betsy Davis and others there, with Marsha Lin, who's still very active in some of this work, to build inquiry-based learning, a program of research on inquiry-based learning for middle and high school students. So my work sort of brought me in into that educational world, and I learned an awful lot in the 10 years at Berkeley about pragmatics, but also about realities of situated research. So building something for the laboratory was my background, but building something for the classroom was a whole nother world. And it was almost another doctorate for me to learn about developing materials, to learn about partnering with teachers, to learn about building technologies, which is something I already had a background in. But technologies for the classroom, and the internet was new at that time. If you guys can even remember back to 95, 96, when the web was coming out, we didn't even have browser frames. And so we were trying as a group there at Berkeley to build a learning environment in the web for middle and high school science. And this would cut across domains, and it would cut across at least 6 years of schooling. And the slate was pretty wide open. We had a foundation of work from Marsha Lin's earlier studies in the Computers Learning Partner program, but beyond that, it was really down to the PhD students and what their ideas were and the postdocs. And I see Astrid is out there right now, you know, getting a sense of what that experience was like for some of us who came before. So I'm on the Y slide now. It just shows you a historical screenshot of that kind of scaffolded learning environment. This is what Phil and I and others came to, essentially embedding a sequence of structured interactions within a web browser. It would be done by two kids sitting together, so there was an essential collaborative nature. But the next slide shows that we had a social perspective there. We really did think about kids interacting broadly across the room, being in debate sessions. Phil's work was on a debate context where kids had to build evidence for one theory and another theory and present that out loud socially with critique from peers. So there was quite a bit of design outside of the browser as well. We used online discussions. We had various forms of interaction. To continue the narrative for me, what that essentially came down to was a deep and deepening understanding about the role of scaffolding technologies in the classroom. Phil left in 98. I stayed on until 05. So 7 more years I spent kind of honing in and honing in, thinking about teacher partnerships in terms of design and development, going to classrooms, looking at how these technologies worked. And it continually came out that the technology itself changed the type of things that were happening in the room. And from Jerry's lens, you could call that the interactions in the room. When you had 32 kids sitting at 16 computers, yeah, there was a lot of overhead to that. You had to make sure they were on the right, you know, URL, and you had to make sure they could log in and get their passwords and et cetera. So there was a bit of overhead, but it also very, very clearly took the teacher off the front of the stage, put the teacher in the room, and if it was done at least the way we were hoping it would be, when we talked to teachers, we tried to help them understand this, it really gave the teacher a chance to talk deeply to the kids about their ideas, to look at what was on the screen, to have that visual and engaged interaction around what the student ideas would be, and then to sort of pop up and give guidance and kind of overall discussion to the room, to the whole classroom. So there was this sort of pedagogical dance that we articulated, and there's a WISE book that details that, and a bunch of research as well. And this was my first orientation, essentially, to the notion of a technology environment that could scaffold the discourse and the patterns of interaction within the room. It wasn't long, and it was 02, 03 that I started thinking, wouldn't it be neat if we could have what happened on one kid's computer influence what happened on another kid's, which still doesn't quite happen in WISE, but Astrid is there working on that. If we could have kids grouped dynamically even across the room based on their interests. We did some of that with the branching and some of the early structures of WISE. But I began to think about more social forms of learning. I was reading Anne Brown, if those of you who know her work. I thought to myself, another thing happened historically, which is that Web 2 came out. I started hearing the word Web 2, which was one thing. Sherry Shi told me about it in 2000 and 2001, something like that. But then we started experiencing Web 2. We started building Wikipedia pages. We started sharing and tagging stuff with wider communities. We started getting blogs and exposure to the online social aspects. And this, I think, really woke up for myself, for some of the people I was working with there, Taraj Al-Ahmad, and others, a sense of these kind of knowledge-building capabilities of technologies. And then when you reread some of the stuff that we were reading, I had read for 10 years from Scardamalia, Ryder, Anne Brown, they started to make a new kind of sense. They started to make a more personally relevant kind of sense. And of course, given where we were with our technology development, it really popped out at us. We wanted to have a Web 2 dimension to this. We wanted to have kids co-building resources. And that sort of was the beginning of my orientation to thinking about a knowledge community approach. And I'm on that slide now, number 8, looking at just some of the images of knowledge community approach, and without saying that this is an actual definition, just some of the terms and features that I see there are that students work collectively. They see themselves as that is what that is about, that I'm about building something with my peers. To aggregate and edit a corpus of materials. So in knowledge building, that's in the knowledge forum. In other projects, that could be in a wiki. That the students at some level, and we'll get into that, they drive their own kind of learning. They define their own questions and methods, and they feel that they're sort of at the steering wheel. There's an emphasis on community identity. They see it as us doing this, not as me within a small group or anything like that. If you read Anne Brown especially, you'll see a focus for her on discourse, that the community kind of defines its own language and norms that, as well as practices. There is a distribution of expertise that seems natural and I think is true of most communities. One thing you'll often see in some other slide down below, there's often a kind of comparison to the scientific community. I guess that partly comes out of our own belonging to that community, but of thinking that we work that way, and we distribute our expertise, we share our knowledge, we build on one another's knowledge, and we collaborate. And by the way, Web 2 has given rise to new forms of Science 2.0 as well, which is an interesting topic in and of itself. There are several prominent lines of research in what I would call the knowledge community approach: Scardamalia and Berider, Hakkarainen, Brown and Campione, actually I'd add Cindy Jimelo, Jerry Stahl, and others who have thought about this. Jianwei Zhang in Albany, New York, is a leader here. Iris Tabak and others are kind of involved in this line of thinking. I guess one of the important points I'm going to make is that it's a tough line of work to get into, to get a teacher to transition from a classroom of kids who are learning in that industrial age modality, or even as sort of small group learners, to thinking about a collective approach, to thinking about the classroom as maintaining a collective identity and a community identity. There are several good reasons why this line of work has made slow progress in the literature. Why we're not all running around doing FCL studies. When John Bransford in 2000 gave a keynote and said that he thought Anne Brown's work was one of the most genius elements of the learning sciences literature that has ever happened, you would think that in a scientific community, if that is what we are, you'd see a lot of activity around FCL, a lot of people picking that up and trying it out, innovating, differentiating, forking. But it turns out that it's a really hard kind of work to do. And for example, if you're a PhD student, you wouldn't undertake this kind of thing lightly. You're going to have to get married to a teacher virtually. You're going to have to, it's going to take at least a couple years, is something Scartamelia has told us, to get that epistemic climate set up. And then to study it, it involves a quite intensive, Phil's group in Washington would be well suited to do this kind of work, but it takes quite an intensive, deep look at the kind of things that are happening in that community. So I felt in my approach to this, in my entry to this kind of work, there were some things that we could take on, some of the specific challenges. So, why hasn't this stuff happened as often in secondary science, chemistry and biology? And some of the challenges there are, if you're going to have kids doing this unfettered, self-determined inquiry, coming up with their own neat ideas that they want to look at and how they're going to look at it, it's a lot easier to do that in elementary school than in chemistry or bio, where you're challenged to cover the content. And I don't think you can just blame, current heavy learning expectations on that. There is stuff in secondary science that you have to cover, and it's not necessarily easy to get that through student-generated inquiry. If you're a teacher, some of the problems with this are that the interactions are quite complicated. It's not easy to be a kind of a facilitator. It's much harder than lecturing, for example, and it takes a lot of pedagogical content knowledge to get that to get up to speed on how to do that. If you're having the kids generate a knowledge base and use it, that's actually a whole other set of skills and technological pedagogical content that need to be done. There is this element of epistemology that the teacher, including the teacher's own ideas about learning, the teacher needs to be reflective and thoughtful about where the kids are coming from. If the kids are out there wondering how they're going to get graded on this, that sets you up for problems. And then, of course, some pragmatic issues around assessment. So this is sort of the turning point and the first part of the talk today, that essentially what I started out to do was to respond to these challenges. It occurred to me that there were a couple of, intrinsic ones, like the tension between individual learning and collective knowledge building. I'm on slide 11 now, research turning point. I wanted to start thinking about Web 2 at that time and how to get kids to kind of cooperatively build a wiki and then use that wiki as a resource. I saw that there was a problem if you went completely off into unfettered inquiry or student-defined inquiry. And I set out to develop a model, an explicit model, that could give a bit more structure, I guess closer to FCL, in terms of the grouping and the linkage to disciplinary content. I targeted secondary science as a requirement of that. Doesn't mean that that's the only place it can be run, but it was certainly where I said I had to prove that this model could be effective. And I got into that line of work. And the paper that you hopefully received and read talks about the current state of the model. That'll be the next segment of the talk that I'll present. And certainly has built on the work of several PhD projects and long-standing partnerships with teachers, but this is the introduction. So we've got now here on slide 12 a couple of discussion questions that I put together, which don't have to be the ones we necessarily address, but one of them is sort of, what are the challenges for the teacher? If you were a secondary science teacher, how would you get kids to understand and come up with their own questions about hydrogen bonding or biological evolution. And I'm not talking about a kind of one-off little supplemental thing. This is how they're supposed to learn this stuff. What are the challenges there? And another one I came up with was, how hard do you think it would be if kids are coming into class in 10th grade or 9th grade with these deep-seated expectations about performing and learning science, and I have to learn this and I'm going to get a good grade? How hard are those things to unseat? Phil, you guys in Washington probably know more about this than we do, but certainly it's one of the major challenges we've confronted to talk about that with kids and teachers. So there were my discussions, and I see some chat input here. Let me have a look. Oh, Frank just typed them in. So I think with that, I'm going to stop broadcasting, get off the stage, and let people come to ask their... Well, let me see. Frank, am I right? Now, you wanted to sort of let the respective groups retreat for about 5 minutes and talk amongst themselves to think about whether either, if these are the right questions, or if they have their own questions around the essence of collective inquiry, then we go from there. Is that right? And then in about 5 minutes, we'll Frank will now say something, and then we'll come back and have a social.
Yeah, I think that would be one way to go. Maybe 4 minutes is also okay, because these are quite easy questions.
Okay, go talk amongst yourselves for 4 minutes, and I'll set my timer here, and we'll come back and ask and talk amongst yourselves for a few minutes after that.
Hi, Freitas. Questions that has to be that have to be reflected on or discussed are in the chat.
Okay, I'm on timer here, and I watched 4.5 minutes go by. Maybe we have a few comments from the audience, and we want to get into some discussion for 5 or 10 minutes here. I see we have a couple of new people have joined. Maybe they could be the first ones to come up with questions. That's not fair.
Hi. We talked over here, we put a bit of stuff in the chat as well, about a project-based learning project we did last year around, it was a year-long biology unit for high schoolers. And we talked about, in terms of thinking about the individual learning versus collective learning, how just having an overarching framework that's really based around an authentic question. So I worked on the evolution unit, which was really structured around, again, an authentic live question in evolutionary biology, such that students did hit sort of learning targets that they needed to for standardized assessments, but within that there was so much space for student choice and driving what they were interested in that it seemed to hit the mark in a lot of ways. So having that larger overall structure, but room within that for students to find their way.
So we've been discussing about both questions, and for the first question, I myself, as a physics teacher, thought that it would be really hard for me to see my class building knowledge, and I mean, they might be building it in the wrong way, or at least what I'm thinking is the wrong way, and I would have to stand beside them, just letting them go on and find their error, or perhaps even not find their error, and this would be really, really hard for me. And as you said, it's easier to just give a lecture than to really facilitate community learning. Oh, your flash just died. Well, I hope you heard everything anyway. And I'm going to pass it on to the second question here to my left.
Yeah, I also had in mind, before thinking about the shift from individual achievement to collective knowledge building, we should also think about a teacher shift from like a knowledge transfer role into a social artist role, which is really hard for the students to try and build this kind of role as well, in order to foster, first of all, community sense in the classroom, in order for the students also to be willing to build on knowledge sharing and collective knowledge building.
Okay, so I think Jim's flash has crashed again, or at least I can't see him anymore. We're going to give the floor to the others.
Okay, so maybe I can say a little bit until Jim is back online. I've been thinking about this idea like individual knowledge creation and collective knowledge creation within the context of WISE, within this tool that's called Idea Manager, where you collect ideas throughout a project that students do. And a question that we have been asking ourselves is, for instance, like when during, you know, during a lesson or during a project, when is the moment to actually start with collective inquiry? Like, is that something we should do from the beginning? Is the moment to share out and to publish ideas so that others can see the ideas? Should this be done right in the beginning? Or is an individual phase, as for instance the brainstorming research would suggest, something that is more important in the beginning, and then you share out at a later time, and then you come up with collective ideas and you shape your ideas based on what the others are saying?
I think that's a nice way of asking that question, and you know, and I see Phil pointed to the NRC framework. To me, I think it starts with the nature of science. So, a perfect way into this would be to say to the students, "This is how science works," and I believe that's probably where Brown and Campione were coming from it when they wrote their papers. That you help kids understand that the science progresses through building on each other's ideas, collaborations, social aspects, and making ideas visible and accessible. And then from our experience, what you do is you add activities very early on where it doesn't necessarily need to be in the Idea Manager. That can come in later. But you could have an icebreaker activity early on where they would see the opportunities from their, you know, collective activity, and the way that becomes kind of all the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and something brainstormy or game-like that lets them sort of get a sense of how that can work.
Well, I wondered this idea of collective inquiry. There is a philosophical discussion in the last decade on collective intentionality, and what I took from there, as far as I understood it at least, they see it as being two quite different modes of, for example, reasoning or feeling or perceiving. So there is an individual and there is more a collective mode that also should be considered differently. Maybe this question is too general, but my question would be, well, one thing is collective inquiry. Is that a possibility also to more or less develop the skills for other collective reasoning, and even a broader for collective intentionality? So could that be seen as a kind of training environment also in a broader context? And the other thing is, how would you or the others feel are these two connected, the collective inquiry and the individual? So there is the Vygotskian perspective that is around in all of these webinars and all of the learning sciences, of course. I think it's maybe not the only perspective. So, oh, now we lost Jim. Was maybe too tough a question, I'm not sure. So now he's back. Oh, and obviously he got at least a part of his question. Hi, welcome.
I got it. I lost the last a little bit, but I know you well enough that I can fill it in. I don't know why this keeps dropping, by the way, and I hope it doesn't drop when I'm presenting, but it takes just a minute to come back. I think one part that I forgot to mention early and the earlier section is something to do with this whole notion of 21st century learning that you hear about. Turns out that stuff's real. Schools today are mismatched to the knowledge work, they sometimes call it knowledge work, that happens in the real world. Continuing this paradigm of training kids in this kind of 20th century or 19th century even mode of expressing content for them to digest and assimilate is not a good preparation for the work that they're going to end up doing, which more and more involves being able to think on your feet, to collaborate with others, to build new solutions. And we've been saying these things in the inquiry community for 15 years. You're starting to see them show up in the new standards. But essentially, to ask that question is one thing, but to answer it is another thing. So it really is going to take some major innovation for the kind of things that happen in the classroom and the kind of stories we tell teachers and the activities we give students for those transformations to really happen. And Franck, I don't know about necessarily, whether this is transfer that you'd be talking about, but certainly, no matter how you want to define transfer, engagement in these kind of reasoning, these kind of collective and collaborative learning processes could not hurt your chances of being able to succeed across contexts when you come out, and that would include at the university level. I think these questions go right up the stack to higher education now, where engineering has been one field for a long time that has talked about the fact that the skills you learn are more about at a higher level than the particular content. But I think increasingly across domains we are seeing the need to sort of take the whole educational epistemology to a deeper level.
Hi, Jim. I don't know. Can you hear me? I hope I didn't do the sound check. I'm sorry for being late. I didn't hear the beginning of your presentation, but I was thinking about a second question, and I don't know, maybe it was mentioned before, but this unseating of students is something that I think they had to be seated somewhere before, so they should, I would say, should be a natural interest rather in collective knowledge advancement, as you said, and maybe somewhere in there, and that's in the system of schools, I think they had been seated to look at their individual achievements. So yeah, that was what I'm thinking about.
Okay, well, my clock is telling me that's a good transition point, Freitas. I think what I'm sharing with you is the problems that we struggle with. We have not solved these problems. What I will present to you now is the kind of theoretical tack that we've taken, and it could be seen as both lightweight and heavy, in the sense that when you implement these kind of approaches with teachers in classrooms, and we saw this with WISE, by the way, but certainly when you take on something like a 12-week semester in high school physics or biology, you need the requirement, the outcome requirement, that it has to work. So there's no, failure's not an option. And so what essentially comes out of it are a bunch of approximations or trying to get there. And I do think that it doesn't have to be binary, where you've got a litmus test that you can do to say, is it individual epistemology or is it collective epistemology? We have tried, and we've always worked in close collaboration with the teacher in a co-design mode. The teacher's at our design table for great length, and we've tried essentially to address teacher epistemology through that approach. We only work with partner teachers. It's not that we don't care about extending this or expanding it, but I think the feeling in our lab, certainly in my own work, is that I need to understand how this works with one context, with one teacher in one classroom, and really study it closely before I go thinking about, could another teacher adopt this or anything like that. As an aside, I think that was one thing that compromised WISE over the years, is that we were trying to build it so that any teacher could use it, and we had these 3 and 4 week units that we wanted to run, but teachers wouldn't run 3 and 4 week units. So as a result, the WISE program, kept getting negotiated with the real world to come down to these sort of 4 and 5 day units, and the technology needed to be bulletproof so you wouldn't have hands in the air. And there wasn't anything wrong with that either. But the work that we're doing here is extremely situated, close partner teachers, and even then, we're still making progress in those relationships. But let me tell you about the model. So the idea was, as I mentioned at the closing of the last segment, to come up with a sort of a structural model. It was inspired greatly by Web 2.0. And when I first entered into this with Vanessa Peters back in 06 to think about it, we were talking in those terms. We really liked this idea of student-contributed content. We liked this idea of tagging and voting, where the student materials became the resource. We also took on this notion that, in essence, we wanted a mashup of the kind of knowledge-building, open inquiry, collective epistemology, and the structured inquiry of that I was familiar with from WISE. So I wanted to say, in essence, that I did not want to throw that baby out with the bath. I wanted kids to be engaged in fairly well-structured, targeted activities who had outcomes that were, you know, known by the designers to produce accessible objects that would be indexed explicitly to the learning goals. So I don't care what you do, it is going to come out with something that delivers me, the teacher or the researcher, an accessible object that I can grade, that whether, you know, you had these elements of the science figured out. So we sort of went into those as design requirements. And just quickly, you know, talking about this as a pedagogical model, right? Maybe more than a theoretical model. This is a model that is supposed to produce instructional designs. It's got structural, functional, and relational assertions that it makes. It is connected deeply to a domain, so it indexes hard to that domain. The knowledge base that we build is extremely indexed to that domain, including the learning processes. So if part of that domain is that a certain kind of inquiry, that would be part of it, as well as epistemic pieces. So it produces testable high-level curricular scripts. And these scripts are they're an artifact of our science. So I can share them. I can hopefully eventually get them into a symbolic state where they become something that I can operate on with some sort of markup. So you know, the slide 16 is the colorful candy looking picture of the model. I think it's still quite relevant that you'll see these kind of persistent, somewhat sequential, but also overlapping relationships where you've got the orange box that makes, you know, that is collaborative knowledge construction, producing the knowledge base. The red box in the middle, scaffolded inquiry activities. These are the kind of structured experiences that kids have where they are guided to create, for example, a design project around climate change that has complete open-endedness, except they have to have the following headers in their project, right? So we give them some room to run, but we also make sure that they cover this, this, and this. You're not allowed to know those completely in advance. So you see at the bottom the red box here with the emerging themes and voices. This only works as a community-based epistemology if the kids feel like this came out of their achievements in the orange square. So these red boxes are really tricky to design. You have to have the content expectations as a feed-in, and you have to have the emergent themes as a feed-in. And then the yellow circles are these accessibles. So I'm sort of trusting that people had at least a look at the paper. I know that this only came to you a couple days ago. But essentially there are major elements to KCI. So KCI stands for Knowledge, Community, and Inquiry. I do see it as a sort of a tweener in that it is structural and it does involve activities, but it also involves student voice and student ideas and a sense of collective epistemology. We push on that quite hard. We are all in this together. This is how we're going to learn. There is a knowledge base that becomes the kind of the beacon of activity, as well as a resource for the inquiry. That's a key part of the slide above, by the way. That knowledge base, the way you design those red boxes, you need to require that knowledge base be used across the index. So if that index is to the 12 principles of physics, they have to use all 12. So it's something kind of structural there. Let's go to the principles. So these have shifted and evolved over the last, you know, year or two. you know, Frank asked me to mention something about how this model has come to be, as well as the artifact that you have, the paper, because he feels that the students involved, they learn and appreciate hearing about how these things emerge in the scientific community. This paper was part of my sabbatical in 2011-2012. I had been working on KCI for long enough and presenting it at all the ICLS and CSCL conferences that I knew it was time to write it as a theoretical piece. And we had these principles somewhat articulated, but yeah, the idea that each of them would hold an epistemological commitment and that they would have pedagogical affordances and technological opportunities, that sort of came out during that sabbatical year. And something that happened to me last year was if you look at slide 19, the ones with the triangles, jumped out at me that, you know, there's some, I just throw up this Engstrom's activity system triangle, and without going deep into that, the next one, KCI design tensions, it just sort of occurred to me that I'm working within this design space where you have a commitment to a certain form of epistemological activity. There are some pedagogical affordances that reveals, and if you read the paper, you'll see what those are specifically for each of the four principles. And then there are some technology bits and pieces that implicates, but as well, the technology pushes back on what you can do pedagogically, right? So there's this kind of neat triangular tension, and without going deep into it, I'm thinking that activity systems might be a way to think more deeply about it. So the first couple principles are basically about this knowledge base, that it needs to be created by everybody. It needs to be indexed explicitly to the knowledge, to the learning domain, and the learning goals within that domain, as well as the practices. And that for each of those, it's not just we all cooperate and fill it in, that we're also working on other people's contributions, rising above and building on, as Marlene said. And that this is seen by our community as something that we are building together that is greater than the sum of what we could do separately, and that it is going, we're doing it knowing that it's going to be used as a resource subsequently. So the third principle in slide 22 essentially says that you have to design these unbound inquiry activities that are when bound to what comes out of the community, they will produce accessible learning outcomes. And there's a few populated bullet points there and in the paper about how that works. Staring at my time here. You'll see a bubble chamber in slide 23. This is my mind on student inquiry. This is how I imagine individual learning is happening within a KCI curriculum. These kids are, if you think about it as a bubble chamber, for those with a physics background, these kids are entering with their own spin and velocity and mass and trajectory on any given conceptual challenge. And they encounter the fields other particles of the KCI curriculum. Our design, we thought about it this way with WISE as well. We try to design a single WISE project that can give every kid who comes through some opportunity for them to develop their own understanding. It's a tricky way to design, and when you add a social dimension to it, you're making a few critical assumptions. But basically the idea is that by exposing kids to opportunities to reflect, and this is where the inquiry part of KCI comes in, with constructivist connections to their peers, with materials that kind of demand them to make sense and make their own sense, and with their individual physical and virtual learning environments, you can assume and even measure individual inquiry. So if you don't see that in this bubble chamber diagram, please change the channel and we'll get away from it. So principle number four about the teacher, this is something that really jumped out at me with WISE in my past. Where we sort of had that pedagogical dance that we had invented for the teacher, that they should go wander the room and interact deeply with kids and all that. But it often didn't turn out that way. It often was the case that teachers were somewhat paralyzed or at least nervous about interacting with such a well-structured inquiry activity where the kids really had everything right in front of them. And, you know, maybe my job instead is to just make sure that nothing goes wrong, right? Or to kind of chit-chat with kids so they feel it's okay. And by the way, those are both fine. But there was never a consequential role, per se, for the teacher. Not never, by the way, if I'm thinking about Phil's work. It wasn't always the case in our designs of WISE projects that we had clear, scripted interactions for the teacher that they had, and they knew that this thing was coming off the rails unless they handled a particular junction. And we thought about what those could be, but the technology and the paradigm that we were designing in were not really suited to that. So in KCI, where we have much longer units, obviously everything depends on the teacher, but we script that very deliberately. So the teacher will often have to make consequential moves, decisions, even gatekeeping, but also decision-making about conditions or topics, groups. How do we help that? Because that could be equally paralyzing if the teacher's just you can imagine the information and cognitive load could be so great that the teacher would be unable to actually do it. So that's going to be the third session of the talk, which is to do with technology supports for orchestration. But in essence, we have come to the principle in KCI that we need to have a very clear statement about what the teacher is doing, and we need to write that into the script, and then we need to build technology to enable that. So this is a little bit similar to, now I'm on slide 25, research methods, KCI studies. Sandoval's conjecture-based model design research is reminiscent of this, and I've come up with a term I call model-based design research, and I like to distinguish it from the kind of pure design-based research in the sense that there is a theoretical model. I guess that's similar to these designs that we come up with can be held against. So if you come up with a KCI curriculum, I can actually look at all the elements of that and tell you if it is a good fit to the model. Like, do you actually have assessable learning outcomes? This is before you even run the thing, right? And so the design nature of it is no less, but the theoretical structure to what you're trying to design is driven by a model and then also informs the model. And this is a paper still maybe waiting for the next sabbatical, I'm not sure. But it's, in essence, we're practicing this kind of research, and there's plenty for me to write about. It is done with a co-design method where teachers are part of the process, and the outcome is typically something that runs for several weeks at least, but usually several months. We talk about scripting and orchestration, and scripting essentially is a topic that you're hearing more and more in the literature. It makes a lot of sense to me, where in essence the, and there is work on this, by the way, in slide 26, scripting slide, I sort of mentioned a few of the people that I followed, including Richard Anderson with his collaborative reasoning, Anne Brown and Joe Campione, Ingo Kohler, Pierre. But in essence, that the script is the structural specification of the roles, the groups, materials, activities, requirements. There's this thing that we call pedagogical logic, which is sort of conditions for transition. And even this notion of unbound or open-ended scripts, where I write it explicitly knowing that the parameters need to be filled in by what's coming down the road to allow for emergent phenomenon or real-time data mining by agents. So that is my concept of a script. As a quick walkthrough, I have slides here around the, you know, probably the first serious KCI unit, which was a climate change unit. Something that was really cool, I'm on slide 27, about this unit, was the fact that it went across five class sections. That's 108 kids, grade 9 science class. I had been working in WISE for 10 years. I had never seen anything that would run across five sections, that they would collaboratively build something. That's three different teachers. And it worked. So we were able to evaluate the design according to the model, we were able to revise it and critique it, and then we were able to analyze the enactment of that model. We used a Drupal platform, which is basically a wiki with a lot better a lot better control over tagging and sections and co-editing and that sort of thing. The overview of it, which we'll go quickly through, there was a 1 week treatment of epistemic elements. So we talked a lot about the nature of science, Wikipedia, big science, collaborative projects, the Human Genome Project, and we talked about the fact that they would be learning that way in this class. So it was an extremely reflective activity. We had them do a brainstorm to sort of break the ice there. They had to work together across five sections to brainstorm the climate change issues that would become the trunk of their whole curriculum. So the first class just kicked out ideas, and I had a little animation of this, but I didn't include it. It was really complex. The second class took the butcher paper, we used butcher paper, and they actually added more ideas. The third class sorted the ideas into themes. The fourth class worked harder on the sort and named the themes, and then the fifth class actually added those themes into Drupal and defined the actual climate change issues that would become their the main corpus of their work. And then at the end, there was 2 weeks of an inquiry project. This was kind of the red boxes where they had to use those 14 issues and come up with a climate change plan that targeted the key learning goals of the course. So the next few slides are really just sort of showing what that looked like in terms of pedagogical and epistemic elements and technology scaffolds. Looking at slides 28-29 have to do with the brainstorming issue that I just mentioned. If you look at slide 30, you'll see the grouping of kids. So then we grouped the kids across section, right? So we had at least two sections involved. These are the five sections. I don't know, what is this? I'm not sure what these six pages are. Whoops. There was a complex grouping of kids so that you had two or three of the sections of the course working on these issue pages. Each of the issue pages was structured in a very interesting way. I don't think I have... Oh, I see there's an animation involved down here. So on slide 32, you see that's just a picture of the butcher paper above, and you see that the issues here are the outcome of that brainstorm activity. Slide 31 talks about the main chunk of time that was spent doing these issue pages. Now, the issue pages were structured, so this is part of where KCI claims its ability to guide students toward an explicit end. On each of the pages, we had four sections, which were carbon sinks and sources, greenhouse effect, energy circulation, and modeling, scientific modeling. Okay, these were the four that the teacher wanted to make sure were present in all of their work, and they were in sequence covered by the teacher in the other activities in the course. So as part of that, the students had to do their issue page editing, and they actually populated these issue pages along those four dimensions. So there's a funny animation on slide 32 that shows how the five sections of kids pumped into the 16 different issues that were there. And they spent on slide 33 just shows you the blank slate of what these issue pages looked like when they started. At the end, they were usually at least, I think I put some facts at the bottom, 4,000 or 5,000 words long, with tons and tons of edits, lots of collaborative edits, and that was a whole topic of a dissertation by Hedia Najafi, who cannot be here today, but Nasheen Zhao also is looking at the teacher's role in this project. Part of the support were these sort of overview planning pages. We saw that the groups to conduct their work needed to have to-do lists and issue tracking and this sort of thing, and so we built a little Drupal page on slide 34 to help them coordinate that, and those were quite actively used. And then finally, we actually did some little inquiry prompts during this knowledge building phase where we actually surveyed them, asked them to do reflections at a personal level as well as about collaboration. And we did, I think, 8 or 9 of those over the 8 weeks or so of the knowledge building or the issue pages. Slide 36 talks about the culminating inquiry project, where the kids were asked to create a remediation of climate change. So they had to address at least a couple of regions of Canada, and they had to address at least 3 issues from the knowledge base. They worked within a class section on this because this became an accessible object that the teachers were looking at, and they wanted to have their own kids working on that part of the project. The outcomes of this, just sort of very quickly, there are 2 or 3 papers about this if anyone's interested that we can send you. But essentially that the remediation projects were very deep. They were indexed to the accessible outcomes, and that the students took it very seriously. They worked collaboratively, but they also had to document what they contributed. And they all did, this is a very good school, by the way, so they were going to do well on climate change no matter how you dished it out to them. But this worked, and they achieved high on the post-test, and they had a deep learning of climate change as a result. So from my perspective, as a scientist, this was a tremendous win that the model actually produced engagement, it produced collective and collaborative inquiry, it produced individual reflections and inquiry, and the teacher didn't hate us at the end. So that was all something. And I think from me, this is phase 2 discussion. That slide is 40 is wrongly labeled. That's a good transition point that now you've seen the model that we've built, and you've seen one example of how that was woven into a high school climate change course that worked across 5 sections with 3 teachers. And I've come up here on slide 40 with a couple of questions. No, this is not my questions. Where did those questions go? There's an erroneous slide 40, and slide 41 has. So I think, to be fair, is KCI too scripted to be counted as a knowledge community approach? Maybe it's just another structured inquiry approach. Do you think it would, even so, would it be too hard to learn secondary science this way? And how do you think students would respond to this kind of instruction? So those are my 3 kind of tentative questions there, and maybe we'll pause here and have about 5 minutes for you all to, what's Frank say? Oh, he's just rewriting the questions in case you don't have the slide. Maybe spend about 5 minutes to talk amongst yourselves, and then we'll come back online and share again. Anyone else that doesn't like that idea, speak now. Okay, my clock says go, and I know you guys are probably all involved in discussions that are just blooming. Maybe you could share them with us, somebody.
So my question would be to know if the student had the possibility to determine the roles, or if the roles were defined by a teacher or a tutor. It will be important to know. According to the answer, I would say if the environment were too scripted or not.
Yes, and I wanted to add that I yesterday heard a webinar from Jerome Jensen about group awareness tools. And that's not part of the question, but to have knowledge community approach. Well, to state it like that, group awareness tools might be a way to avoid scripting and only have the group like reflecting what they're doing on a social and on a contentual level. I mean, that might be a way to like bridge to the knowledge building. And we have another question.
Of course, I have not really like much information about this, but my question is, what are the community elements of this besides?
He's gone.
He's gone?
Yeah, I think he's just gone.
So I should wait?
Or? Yeah, we're going to stop broadcasting until he's back on, and I guess he will... he's already back on.
Is he back?
Yeah, he seems to be back, but now Mike is gone, but yeah.
Okay. So I just said that I don't have like much information about this, but I was wondering what are the community elements within this community approach besides the collaborative learning, let's say, that is taking place, and to what extent have the students actually reported the extent to which they perceive this as a community or not? Thank you.
Yeah, that last question is so hard, I'm not going to answer it. Laughter. Just quickly, the first one on the choices that students had, they, you know, there was an aspect of scripting here where we did get them to sort of orient to the issue that they wanted, and the teachers essentially were pretty well able to match kids up. When they got into an issue they were assigned to, they pretty much stayed there. There were a couple of times when kids left to join another issue, and I think we did collapse two issues at one point together. But I love this idea of the group awareness tools and, you know, letting groups be more open-ended about how they make their progress. We did, when we were doing these issues, the issue pages differed a lot. We did say to them, you can do anything you want on here as long as you, you know, do whatever you want as long as you do what I say, right? Do whatever you want as long as you have these headers, and they're going to be assessed according to these rubrics, which we shared. As far as the last question about how much community was here and how much crosstalk was there, crosstalk is a topic introduced by Anne Brown. There were occasions when the teacher, this is one of those places in the script of the teacher's role, was asked to enable, to support kids to talk across their issues about carbon sinks and sources, about energy, energy circulation in the atmosphere, and these sort of topics. You know, at first we had this idea of a jigsaw where you'd get a kid from every group to sit down, and now you'd have, you know, these small groups going at it. That sort of structure, and again, that takes the, that smells a lot like heavy scripting, right, where kids are basically going where you tell them and doing what they're told. And it's a constant tension in this kind of a work. I think we're still learning a lot about how to get the community aspects to take hold, and when kids are specializing in something like that, to allow the products of those inquiry to be available, relevant, and even, you know, built upon by other groups. And this is when you read Scardamelia and Berreiter, when we work with the teachers that we work with for the Walkology project you read about in the paper, which is a grade 5-6 group where that knowledge building is at the core of their identity as a school. It was Marlene Scardamelia's school. They insist on this, and it's one of the real tensions we have with them, is that we tend to want to script everything more than they want it to be scripted. So it is a tough question, and it is pretty much at the heart of our work.
One question that I put into the chat was it's also maybe to you, Jim, but also to all the others. If you develop scripts, what is your main starting point? Is the starting point the epistemic practice or a couple of epistemic practices that you would like to familiarize the students with? Or is it more a pedagogical scenario, or how most Europeans would say a didactical approach that guides your scripting, or is it a combination of both? Because I think as a legitimation for giving people some clear scripts and instructions, I think to guide them through an authentic epistemic activity or practice would be a quite good legitimation, right? So what would you recommend, or what are you using as starting points for these scripts?
Yeah, that's a great question in a way, because it can explain the differences between projects like the climate change, the Walkology, the Evo Room, and Place. And maybe because I brought so much of my work from the WISE days, where in WISE, the individual projects that were created, at least in the beginning, were reflective of the PhD student's particular questions. And so you could have a topic like deformed frogs, or like houses in the deserts, where that topic came from was basically that the student had an interest, respectively, with Phil in argumentation and evidence, and with Chris Hoadley in social information and discourse. But they needed to situate those questions in a curricular context. They needed a sequence of activities that would allow them to start framing their questions in terms of materials, in terms of WISE as a vehicle, in terms of the interactions in the classroom that they required, right? And I think the same thing has happened with us, and it may be that I brought that with me from California, but when you have a student like Mike, who's here, wanted to look at user-contributed content, so kids using their actual experiences and examples and putting that into the community knowledge base. There's also some incidentals, which teacher is available to work with you. So we had, in Mike's case, physics. You know, the physics teacher was ready. We also had some technology things that we were explicitly looking at. So in essence, it's a little bit like the Iron Chef television show, where you're given the ingredients, you know, and so you have these kind of input constraints or directions, and then from there you build the script in a kind of a means end analysis, where you say, I know at the end I have to have the outcome needs to be that these kids have learned these physics principles, and then the KCI principles come into play and they start guiding, much the way that the knowledge integration principles guided our design of WISE projects in a fairly loose but heavily referenced way. I think the KCI principles did that for us with these units, where we had chances to reflect all along the design course, and the script sort of came out in a you know, maybe in the way theatrical scripts come out, where you're first kind of painting a broad picture of how the kind of sequencing is going to work, and if this would actually potentially produce activities that resulted in engagement and reflection. And then you start getting into the more fine point interactions that you need to develop the requirements of the tools and materials, maybe sometimes the constraints of the tools and materials, and then you can't do what you want to do. So there's a lot of trade-offs. This stuff is not easy. It sounds like George Bush. It's hard, but it is. And it doesn't come out exactly right at any moment in time, and there is a design aspect to it. I thought one of the interesting things that, Frank, you've asked me before is, you know, when you finally do come up with a script that seems to hold the KCI principles as well as allow some of these research questions, maybe from there it's time for cognitive science or learning science to move forward with more structured, careful comparison studies, so that I'm not having to design the whole thing again and again, but I can work with the design artifact once it's created, and I think that is a promising direction. Let me ask at this point what you think we should do, Frank. So I have a third section of the presentation that was basically two examples. One of them was the physics example. One of them was the Evo Room example. I gave two videos on the slides that were 1 minute videos basically from each one. And I thought we would be able to start talking about orchestrating these complex interactions. And, you know, one of the recent interests of mine is that the technology, you know, of the internet coming onto a laptop is really 1990s, and we're starting in the 21st century to see these things disappearing into our pockets and into the physical objects surrounding us. There's research from computer science about human-computer interactions and the new forms of engagement that could potentially happen using those types of technologies and interaction design. And so from those two examples, I was going to introduce how we are starting to support distributed scripts where kids are learning in different contexts across the museum and the home and the field, the classroom, as well as smart classroom interactions where the walls and the furniture of the room or where you're standing in the room actually are a consequential role player. I'm happy to talk more about that, and you dub once as the Evo Room, but I see that I know people have scheduled as well, and while there's 50 minutes remaining in this meeting officially, I think we're closing in on the 12:30 mark, so maybe people could voice where they think we should go from here. Because I'm available, but I don't want to push into bonus time too much. One example. Okay, that's fine. So let me say you've got the paper and you've got the slides. You can see from the paper that we're introducing a new technology framework. It's called SAIL, Scalable Architecture for Interactive Learning. It's an example of what Mike and I have been calling a distributed technology enhanced learning. It essentially supports connectivity of all devices through the internet using a messaging protocol, which is an XMPP-like protocol. It uses intelligent agents to process those messages and to respond to them. You can imagine the knowledge community made real in a virtual sense. So the knowledge base becomes a database. We use unstructured data, so we use a MongoDB, and then we specify a data model, which essentially then lets us create these interactions and these agents and the way that we structure our devices and displays. Mike's PhD thesis is essentially about that framework, and it's shown in a slide there. It's shown in a different way in the paper. Part of this work is taking scripts like you see on slide 47 that are explicitly written out that include roles for agents. This is Mike's places physics learning across contexts and environments, explicitly written out and then made real in the form of technology, and you see the agents there are all the little cloud objects. One of the long-range goals of my own work is to come up with a more symbolic way of structuring these kinds of collective inquiry activities. So I won't show the video of place, which you have the URL right in front of you, so hopefully you will go look at it. And I'll move on. But just so you know, that place activity, one of the essences of that work was to really study these kind of technologies, how the what's the information science behind all of that, and how can we create a physics curriculum where the kids were enabled to create their own materials, where there was an explicit index to physics principles, and where there was a culminating activity that the agents kind of helped in real time draw materials out of the knowledge base to support that. So it's, again, a terrific project, and there are papers about it. Back to this idea of the alchemy or the Iron Chef aspect of designing these things, with us right now. She had an interest in a specific technology or a specific approach, which was a room-sized immersive environment. Okay, that's to differentiate that from a immersive environment you might get on a screen where you go into River City or World of Warcraft. This would be more of a cave where you walked in with your peers and collectively inquired of that experience. You might get things on your tablet that pushed you to interact explicitly with that representation. And again, around the KCI modeling aspect, we knew that we could not just sort of build a cool room and have kids walk into it and start inquiring. We talked from the very beginning there. She had an interest in this kind of work, but I asked the question early on, how do you make it so that kids don't just walk? You want to make a beautiful rainforest in the room. This is after we had at least come to the ideas about rainforest. How do you make it so kids don't just walk up to it and say, you know, look at the pretty trees? And we talked about the difference between an expert and a novice. If you actually took these real kids to a real rainforest, you know, before the curriculum, let's say, they'd likely point to the trees and say, yeah, there's a lot of trees there. You know, look at the pretty trees, the real rainforest. Whereas if you took an expert to the real rainforest, they would see all these patterns and all these lines of relationship and historical and evolutionary aspects that that come out of their deeper knowledge about that that domain. So we said, okay, we don't want to bring the kids into this room until they've got some deeper knowledge about that domain. And we want to explicitly connect their knowledge about that domain to the room. So we engaged the kids as a design community around essentially the rainforest intervention. We had them focus on Borneo. We had them focus on and specialize in species, you know, whether it's flora, fauna, primates, as well as on time periods. So was it, you know, 100 million years ago, what were the particular animals and insects and what came out of them? So within this knowledge community, and this was also done across, I think it was two sections of a course, we had them start to populate the content of the Evo room. And Michelle worked with that content to create these kind of rich and animated sequences. So the curriculum itself was designed around the KCI model. The kids had a knowledge base done in Drupal. They had regular reflections. They had knowledge building activities. They kind of passed through a sequence not too unlike the climate change. And then twice during the year they came into this smart room, which is slide 57. You'll see three stitch displays on either side. There's a table in the middle. All the kids have tablets. This is basically coming out of you know, Mike's research on S3. We were able to use the S3 framework to coordinate the various technologies you see here, including the smart boards at the front of the room, which played a huge role. So in the Evo room activity, there were these, I'll just stay on slide 57. On the side displays, you had these animated rainforests that were quite large. They were 15 feet or so in length, and they were beautifully rendered, and they moved, and they had all the animals and insects. You could also move them through time, or the teacher could, using her tablet, right? Teacher could move it from 200 million to 150 million to 100 million. As that happened, what happened on the kids' tablets also changed. And the kids started making observations about the next evolutionary time period. As that happened, all of their observations got aggregated on those front boards as an emergent cladogram, which is a kind of historical evolutionary descendancy graph. So they could sort of watch and see as those relationships emerged, and the teacher, this is important, would be able to then leverage what was coming out of the students to have important or meaningful discussions about evolution, about radiation events. If, for example, they had the topology wrong, as you see on slide 61, you know, how can something get created from two ancestors, right? They could call attention to that, and essentially the room itself became this kind of dynamic knowledge building vehicle where kids knew that they were in something, they knew that they were engaged on a technology, and there was this kind of common product that emerged. So maybe what you could do if you look that shows a picture of the stitched slides, you could exit the PowerPoint and now select that URL, paste that into a browser. This is a 1 minute video, so it just gives you I think it's nice to see it and to hear it. So this is Michelle's research. She was really into immersivity. She wanted to know how you interacted with these media, but also wanted to sort of do some design around the immersivity using audio, potentially in the future, other senses as well. And this one was accepted into the CHI conference this year, so we'll be presenting it at an HCI conference. So go ahead and play this one, and then we'll come back and we'll have a closing discussion. Okay, so thank you very much for thinking so much about our work. I feel quite honored by the attention you gave so late in the year, especially, and the thought to the theoretical bits, to the pragmatic bits. And I hope you can see that, if nothing else, there was a ton of work that went into a lot of this, and thousands of hours of design time, development time. The new technologies that Mike and the group here have been building are very, I think, potentially important for the field, I would hope. The fact that we could build five of these, so in 1 year we were able to build Walkology, Evo Room, Place, a thing for Tim Zimmerman and Rutgers, and another tool that we used at the Sydney ICLS conference, that we could do five in 1 year is, I have a very high standard because of WISE that lets you quickly build an inquiry project, debug it as they were running it, get the data in real time, like that. When you have something like that, you never forget it. And, we're after something like that to support smart classroom work and distributed learning work. We want to have a framework that's never going to be out of the box like WISE, but it's hopefully going to enable this kind of work, which I can tell you when we started, there was nothing that you could use that would make it easy to do. And so I think what we're hoping with S3 is that we will be able to allow others who want to come in and start getting into the almost infinite number of kinds of interactions that you can do to jump on and start accessing the technology. So what kind of questions do people have about these interactions and maybe the relationship with KCI, or what kind of particulars about the technology? And I hope you will watch the physics one because it shows learning across contexts and it shows the agents in a more kind of clear display, as well as the use of ambient, which is something that's quite important to our work.
So I would have a more pragmatic question. How do you think could we bring this into the schools? What would be a good approach to do that? Because on the one hand, I think a top-bottom approach, like just the ministry saying that teachers should do that, won't work. On the other hand, if we have a bottom-up approach, this might take for years, and then technology is even further evolved than it is now. And yeah, what do you think is a good approach?
Yeah, Daniel, I think that an earlier question is whether it's ready. I don't want to take this to schools until I think it's really the kids are learning. And I'm not saying that facetiously, but this is work that is very early stage. This is work that is very basic research into the nature of learning, the nature of human interaction. I would not pretend that it's ready to go out to schools and that kids are going to be able to quickly start learning this way, and it would be a waste of my time and other people's time to try to force that to happen. I'm sure some good things would come out of that, but from my work, what I'm really after right now are these kind of some of the beginnings of asking questions that would potentially lead to materials and tools that could be taken to a school. If the place web and the evolution are both, you know, not too expensive in terms of technologies, you need some projectors and a room to put them in. The actual details of how to do the curriculum, you know, Mike's thing was 12 weeks long of the teacher being asked to do various things at various steps, and Michelle's as well. And those are the kinds of moves within the design and then the enactment that I think are still, we're still trying to understand how well they work for learning. And so I don't have any interest right now in moving this to schools. And I'm not being afraid of that. I'm just saying there's a time and place for that. And if my efforts were spent now thinking about designing this for scaling or for rollout, it would be premature. It would probably compromise the work. And my guess is that it would wind up in something, it would be interesting anyway. I see here a question from Washington. Yes, the goal should be, yes, Daniel. I do have it in mind. It would, again, I had 10 years of making a web-based environment that was all about going out into schools, so it's going to be hard for me to let that go completely. But it sure is enjoyable to let it go a little bit. Phil, I'll bet, had that experience where you just really want to be about this learning sciences question. The culminating product of the students from a disciplinary learning. Yes, okay, so there is some work on that. That is Michelle's current current doctoral work. She is looking at, in essence, a set of reflections that the kids made. yeah, that's true. Wise was run in Germany. The kids made reflections about that cladogram that came out. They actually were asked to trace a species back through the evolution and to talk about particular times in evolution where they could see the radiation happening, where they could see different, there were, I think, four fundamental processes of evolution, and they were asked to reflect about each of those four from their own species track back. And so she is analyzing the content of the explanations around those topics. So again, some of this work is human-computer interactions, but a lot of it is deeply grounded in the discipline and the pedagogy. It's probably trying to paint with too big of a palette, but it's enjoyable to take that all on. And I think that is the province of design work. You get to be more comprehensive, and maybe you lose a bit in the specific questions if we really were asking about, you know, if we were asking very explicit questions about disciplinary understanding. We probably have to be a little bit more focused and narrow on our intervention around that. So it's going to create a fundamental limitation in the analysis, and it's along the lines of what Franck was asking us to do with kind of the sort of next steps of this work, both in the physics and the evolution, is to follow it up with maybe some explicit comparison studies. Okay, so we are at the time that Franck has advised us is the end. Does anyone have any last questions? Franck has his hand up. And
so maybe we make a quick round where every group or every individual participant can say a couple of words, what was surprising or what they take from that talk. Let me first thank you, Jim. That was an excellent webinar from my perspective. Thank you for sharing your model on KCI. Also for the vision that is behind that. I think that's my personal view, and we have discussed about that a couple of times. I think we see a theory developing, or a developing theory here. And I think we need more of this in the learning sciences. And I think this is an excellent a starting point on knowledge building and communities. Also, I think what you showed us last was the vision on how we can use technology to more or less realize but also better investigate these theoretical developments I think it's a kind of artifact-based knowledge generation that I like, especially in your work, your and your group's work. And let me say one thing also, especially to Mike. Thanks, Mike. I think you contributed a lot to Jim's work group. Now he's gone. Basically, I wanted to say that I would like to use this example because I think he had 50 logins now and 50 logouts. So this is really an indicator of interest in the topic. If there is so much trouble to be part of that group, and he is always coming back. So thanks especially also to Mike. Now he's back. So maybe we have a quick round and then Jim with the final words, and then I think we should close that.
Hey, Jim. So thanks for that nice whirlwind of different lines of work. Like, it's really impressive to see how it's developing, and having been along for a fair chunk of that ride and watching you continue to ride recently, like, it's interesting to see just how you get the payoff to be able to kind of develop really innovative new environments in relation to kind of a shifting frame on learning. So it's very impressive. Thank you for sharing. I don't know.
Yeah, thanks for talking more about the Evo room. That was fantastic work to get to see in action.
So we'll follow up soon.
So thank you, Jim, from Germany. We all thought this was a great webinar, and we had some deep discussions, and I'm still overwhelmed by the Ever Room. I think it's really great, and I would have loved to participate in it as a student. And thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Jim, hi. Thank you very much for the talk, and it's really impressive to see the Evo Room developing. Thank you very much. It was very interesting.
Thanks also from me. I've heard about your work several times before. I have to say, like, this time it all made sense. It was a really nice and structured talk, like, also that you explained before where this is coming from, and to understand what your goals are and how these goals are implemented in your work. I think it was a really nice webinar to actually, get the full picture. And we see, and we saw, like, how you were presenting it, that you are taking the long road. It's not something where you run a study and you get the study out there, you write an article, and that's it. You're really taking the wrong note, and I think now it's making sense. So, I wish you success, and I'm very intrigued by your work. Thank you.
Okay, Jim, you missed very positive remarks by Astrid, but there is, of course, a recording of this, and you can look that up afterwards. So maybe some final words from your side, and then I think we have to finish and to close down.
Mike might have stepped away. Well, really, the honor's all mine to have all of you spend this much time focused on our group's work. And there's a slide there, number two in the presentation, that gives thanks to a lot of people. And really, I think that the learning sciences is starting to prove the reality of science 2.0. You're seeing greater levels of collaboration. You're seeing greater levels of kind of building on each other's work. The colloquia that we organize in our conferences, the grants that we write together, the lines of intersection that we see between the work projects from groups, like including WISE and this group here. My close collaborator in Illinois, Tom Moore, has innovated really cool ways of engaging kids with embedded phenomena that are actually literally embedded in the walls of the room. And so I think what you'll see going forward, at least from my work in the next 10 to 20, will be further experimentation around the role of the environment and the technologies to support that, including embodied forms of learning, tangible and embodied interactions, distributed learning, learning where you're actually transporting the knowledge physically could be interesting. And so our group is trying to stay on that very moving roller coaster and paying attention to the multidisciplinary aspects of that work, as well as the theoretical piece that I started off with, which Frank has helped keep me honest to and keep me working on it. I hope you'll read the paper and give me any comments or feedback. Eventually it will be turned into something additionally out in a journal form, but right now it's very happy to have that put in the corpus of work from this series. And again, just to close, to say thanks to Frank for doing this for all of us, and we should all go watch everybody's webinar, because I can imagine the wealth of important content there. So over to you. Have a great holiday, everybody.